with your host, Tim Banal.
No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules, and at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. And when we boast no comparison, really, we're talking about shows like tonight. Nowhere else are you going to hear this, my friends. The annual BOA Audio Holiday Tradition, Ruxgiving, where we welcome back our dear friend, Bruce Rux, to the program. Take listener questions, catch up, talk. It's like sitting around, really. I don't know if it's like this where you live, folks. I think it is everywhere, though. Thanksgiving, you go to the bar on the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, and you run into a whole bunch of old friends, and you catch up, and you talk. That's what Ruxgiving is here for BOA Audio. Bruce Rux, the amazing Bruce Rux, author of Architects of the Underworld and Hollywood versus the Aliens. He's part of the fabric of BOA Audio. He's got a holiday named after him here on the show, for goodness sake, folks. Bruce Rux, welcome back to the show. Looking forward to it this year. I already have a feeling it's going to be a barn burner, my friend.
As always, a pleasure to be here.
Awesome, awesome. And what I like also about the Ruxgiving holidays, it's a lot like Thanksgiving here at my house, because I get to really enjoy quite a feast and I don't have to really do any work. You know, like we leave it up to the listeners to do all that. So, well, let's catch up with you. What have you been up to since the last time we talked to you? It's actually been like a whole year now. We didn't do anything special in the past year to bring you back. So what's been going on with Bruce Rux since Ruxgiving 2013?
Well, mostly I was just kind of consumed with death watch for my mom. She finally passed at the end of last month, a couple of days before Thanksgiving, before Halloween. Hmm. And we buried her on Election Day, sadly, but she was very anxious to move on. She had lived and had all the experiences she wanted in her life and very, very much wanted to move on at that point. She was kind of falling apart. Pretty much my entire year was kind of taken up with that, just taking care of the house, helping take care of her. Death Watch is its own peculiar kind of job. And it's very depressing.
Hmm.
But that is over now, and I'm actually feeling tremendously better. I've seen all kinds of symptoms of coming out of depression as opposed to going into them. And I'm feeling pretty good, actually.
Nice, nice. Yeah, obviously our deepest condolences to you, in the loss of your mom. We talked earlier, so I knew about this. I wasn't surprised when we talked about it. So, just really rough. I went through the whole thing years ago with my dad. So, and as I said, we discussed this off the air. So, it's kind of weird, but it sounds like you're in a good place now. And seems like just from talking to you over the last few weeks and everything, you seem to have a vim and a vigor and really a lust for what's out there right now. So, I think
I'm feeling better than I have in 3 years. I have to say, It's when someone is dying, it's a very depressing thing. Part of you is kind of dying with them. There's a lot that's weighing on your shoulders because there's the suspense involved. It's not death that you're living with so much as dread.
Mm, yeah.
Because you don't know when is it going to happen, how is it going to happen, is it going to go easy, is it going to go hard, how bad is it going to be. But then when that's over, and she passed very peacefully, just by the by, she went well, as I like to put it. Once that's over, once they're dead, there's no more dread. It's all done. The movie's over, you go home, and you get on with your life. And since she passed easily and since she was very, very much ready to go, it was not a surprise, and most of the grieving process had already been taken care of over the last 3 years, so moving on was much, much easier than it would have been otherwise.
That's great. That's great. Well, we'll move on then. We'll get into the Ruxgiving festivities. Again, obviously, though, my heart goes out to you, buddy. I've been
Thank
there
you.
In a lot of ways, so I totally understand what you're going through. Well, as I said before we started the conversation here for the audience, this kind of piqued my interest here, and I'm sure I asked you this, probably in our original conversation on the show years and years ago, but it would be good for a little follow-up and sort of even to focus in a little more, because I'm sure when we first talked it was like, give me your bio background. This time around, I really just want to know kind of what lit the spark for you to bring aliens into your life. Let's put it that
All
way,
right.
You know, because that's kind of a good dividing line between folks out there. You know,
sure.
Most folks I work with, they don't even deal with aliens. So, what was it that got it all going for you?
Well, that's a multi-layered question, but I'll try and keep it as brief as possible. There were several things, and it was over the course of a lifetime. I had had a general interest. I'd always loved science fiction and space stuff when I was a kid. I was one of the original Star Trek fans. Before there was a word Trekkies to describe anybody, I was the original Trekkie.
Nice.
There was that. Outer Limits was one of my favorite TV shows. I was very much concentrated on space and the idea of aliens and things like that. This was only one of many interests, of course. It wasn't an obsession or anything, but certainly it was one of my primary interests. I didn't study UFOs too much when I was a kid, and it wasn't really discussed much around the house, but occasionally it would come up. By the time I hit junior high, ancient astronauts had become a big thing, and I was very much into the ancient astronauts craze, as it were.
Yeah.
Von Däniken may not have been the best scholar. In fact, he was a pretty poor one. But he at least did raise a lot of interesting questions, and like the internet, he was hardly the last place that you could go for. He was hardly in a place you could go for the last word on anything, but he was a great place for the first word on anything.
Ah, that's a great way to put it. I like that. Yeah.
So, yeah. I did a lot of research. There were many better ancient astronaut authors out there, all of whom you will find in my bibliography. I've got an extensive library of them that I've been collecting for years. And again, it was not an obsession. It was just something, it was one of many different subjects that I liked researching from time to time. So over the years, I picked up quite a bit of information. As to what started crystallizing my interest in it, first off would have been the face on Mars back in 1976. I could definitely see a face there. And as shows in my book, I was seeing a different face than everyone else was seeing. It looked to me like a hawk, and I still believe it is. In fact, the later images of it that have been completely unretouched and are just straight shots from 2000 and 2001, I believe, from the Mars probes, look even more like a hawk as far as I'm concerned.
Huh.
Just very straight. It's hard to miss. You can see the figure eight of the beak, where the center of the beak overlaps in the middle.
Interesting. We're going to have to look at this.
Yeah. It's the face of Ra is what it is. And in Egyptian mythology, that's exactly what the Sphinx was supposed to be made in the image of. It was supposed to be made in the image of Ra. Well, our Sphinx plainly isn't, although it could have been at one time. The thing has been resculpted at least once or twice. So there is a possibility that it was at one time. But the one on Mars is a hawk, and a hawk is Ra. So that started my interest in Egyptology and getting some research in on that. Many years after that, there was someone that I had grown up with who had had some extremely peculiar experiences over the course of their life, which they had told me at the time that they happened, and I never quite knew what to make of them. So they just kind of got stuck on a little side file or back burner in my head.
Yeah.
That's where I put anything that doesn't really make a whole lot of sense to me, but might be of interest in someday in future.
Your gray basket, as Stan Friedman calls it.
My gray basket, that's a good way to put it. Many years after that, I came across David Jacobs' book. I had read Bud Hopkins. I had read at least one of his books. I had read Whitley Strieber and was not terribly impressed. Bud Hopkins was also a little bit confusing, but at least the subject was interesting, and I didn't know what to make of any of that stuff. So I actually wasn't studying it too intently at that time, but it was a side interest that I would occasionally pick up and look into. What really gave me a handle on UFO abductions was David Jacobs' first book. His second book went a little bit off the rails, but there were probably reasons for that. His first book was really focused, really centered, and very well studied and structured. What I noticed reading his book was everything that this person I was talking about had told me over the years codified. Literally everything that he was talking about from abductees, this person had told me.
Weird.
At the same ages that he had listed people having these experiences, and I remembered it. I had not talked to that person before I wrote either of my books. I have talked to that person since. They also believe that they are very likely an abductee. What's interesting about that, the person in question had no interest at all in UFOs. I mean, just none. They had a great deal of interest in all kinds of other paranormal subjects. They were interested in haunted houses or psychic phenomena, anything like that. But they really didn't have any interest in UFOs.
Yeah.
But everything that they were describing fit what David Jacobs had outlined, and at the same years. I mean, if someone had an experience when they were like 7 or 8, I remember that person having the same experience right about 7 or 8 and telling me about it.
Yeah, that's a unique kind of like confirmation situation you find yourself
exactly.
In. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, at that point, there are only one of two choices you have. You can say this is either a unique psychological condition that happens to some people, and the person that I know has it, or it's exactly what David Jacobs is claiming it is, and what some of the people involved in it are claiming it is, and that is that they were picked up. Somebody came by and picked them up, and they were doing it repeatedly over the course of these people's lives and performing various procedures on them. I believe the latter, because just applying Occam's razor, that frankly made more sense to me.
Yeah.
I could see how that would fit this particular interpretation far easier than I could some really bizarre and random just psychological thing that didn't have any explanation behind it.
Right, right.
So that kind of focused my interest and got me looking into it a little bit more. At that point, I got back into the ancient astronaut research because I always found that to be the most promising of all UFO research was in ancient astronauts. That's when I read with Zechariah Sitchin and some related authors and got back into my old library on ancient astronauts. At that point, I corresponded briefly with Sitchin and got invited to go on that first trip to Egypt in 1994. And having met him was a very interesting experience. We've talked about that several times before on the show.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, let me. This never really dawned on me, but how did he end up inviting you? Like, it just seems really random. Just from correspondence that he saw you were interested in it, or you know, it just seems kind of like wow, you really lucked out in a sense to be invited to go to Egypt. I mean, that's pretty big. That's a pretty big sort of honor, if you will.
He just happened to be organizing his first trip. He was just going on a first trip to Egypt. And since I was in correspondence with him, he thought, well, you might be interested. Would you like to come on this thing? And, you know, what am I going to say? No.
Wow.
So,
yeah.
Sure, I went ahead. A very interesting trip and has been talked about again several times prior for all kinds of reasons. It was interesting. But in any event, that was where I met him, and it was in the course of that trip, he really didn't have anything to do with this, but it was in the course of that trip that I decided I might try and write a book on UFOs and ancient astronauts and all of my research, because I did have an entire lifetime of research behind me, and it was especially focused at that time, and that's exactly what I did.
Nice. All right. I think that brings us up to speed on the bio background. I don't think you'd ever told the story about your friend before on here. I don't remember ever hearing that.
Way back, I think, in the first, when we did the three-part thing with Hollywood versus the Aliens.
Okay, yeah, maybe, yeah. I'll trust your memory better than mine on that. All right, very interesting, very interesting. I feel like I could go even further into this, but we have all these listener questions, so...
Oh yeah, certainly.
You know, we'll save that. We'll continue that. We'll serialize that
sure.
for down the line. And so as I joked at the beginning here, what I like about the Rocks Giving thing is I really don't have to do any work because people send in all these questions. But now this year, folks just sent in. It was a handful of folks, but they sent in a ton of questions. So it's quite a mass of material to dig through. And I did everybody a favor by making sure that I compiled all these, got them all together, sent them to Bruce ahead of time, so we weren't both kind of scratching our heads like...
They're mostly pretty good, also.
Yeah, yeah. Like, what's Deep Space Nine? That's me. I would be saying that. Bruce knows what it is. But anyway, so let's just dive on in. The first one here comes from Mark. He says he is near the Monster Loch in Scotland. So we're already starting out with an emailer internationally. Paranormal location as well, and
I'm interested in Nessie, by the way.
Really?
Yes.
Let's stop there and talk about that first. What's your interest in Nessie? What do you? Because I've kind of given up on Nessie. I'm kind of like, I think it was probably, you know, I don't think it was that big a deal. But
yeah, I don't have any kind of solid evidence that Nessie exists or Bigfoot either, for that matter. But I'm interested in cryptozoology.
Yeah. Interesting.
There's not a whole lot of story to that. I'm interested in cryptozoology.
Okay.
I'll bring one up as a cryptozoological interest. If anyone's ever heard of the Beast of Gévaudan, the Beast of Gévaudan was some kind of monster that tore a whole lot of people apart in France during, I forget which Louis's reign it was, and exactly which year. I think it was in the 1700s. I'm going back in my memory here. It's been a long time since Silence of the Beast gave it on.
Oh, I think I saw like a Discovery Channel special about this thing.
Yes, you probably have seen several.
Hmm.
I think they largely answered that question pretty well. They suggested that the thing was actually, that it actually existed, and that what it probably was a hyena. And at first, I thought, you know, that's, how would you get a hyena in France? And I thought, what the hell am I talking about? I did all kinds of research on pirates. There was trade going back and forth all over the place, and lots of ships went to Africa.
Hmm.
You could get a stowaway hyena easy, or someone could have picked one up. And this one appeared to be either relatively trained or at least semi-controlled. But yeah, I came to the conclusion that they were probably correct that this was a hyena that was killing a bunch of people out there. It matched the description pretty well. It certainly had the capacity to have done so, and is the type of animal that would have committed the kind of killings that were described.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that they pretty well nailed that one on the head. But that's just an example of my interest in cryptozoology and trying to answer strange creatures like Nessie.
Interesting. Do you have an opinion on what Nessie is then?
My own guess is if Nessie is there, and I'm not going to rule out that Nessie is there, probably a misplaced plesiosaur. There might be a small school of them still living under there all the way back from whichever prehistoric age they came from, just because the conditions are right for them, and they just continue breeding.
Interesting. That seems like the popular sort of idea in the mainstream, but most people, it kind of dismiss it as implausible. So why do you think that's even, because I've always been kind of like, I thought it was the body of water was too small for a breeding population of these things in there.
It may have some channel we don't know about where it goes.
Hmm.
I really don't know. There are all kinds of different dinosaur reports from different parts of the world or what sound like dinosaurs, especially South America. There are descriptions that sound like a Diplodocus, an upright thing with a particular fin on top of its head. It sounds like a Diplodocus to me. I mean, every kid has studied, boys anyway, every boy who was ever in elementary school has studied dinosaurs. And
yeah.
I did a lot. So I'm getting this description and saying, well, you know, that sounds very much like a Diplodocus, and I don't think these people in South America know what a Diplodocus is. So my guess is, if it is there, that's probably what's running around somewhere in South American jungles, and we just don't see it because the South American jungles are pretty big.
Yeah.
They're just deep in there, that's all, and occasionally someone sees one. And people didn't believe that gorillas and orangutans were real either until someone brought one back.
Yeah, exactly. Very interesting. All right, so Mark near the Monster Loch in Scotland. I also have to give him credit. He wrote, we wrapped up season 8 on October 30th. With plans to do this show tonight, essentially. I had pretty much the 25th penciled in. And kudos to Mark. He actually sent the email 2 days after we wrapped up the season. He sent it on November 1st before I just said we were going to do a Ruxgiving. And next thing I know, I had already gotten an email from someone with questions. So that's how fervent the Rux fans are in the audience. So here's the first batch of questions, really, from our listeners. Mark, near the Monster Loch in Scotland, he says, from my background as a stonemason, I would value Bruce's thoughts on the parallels he may have mused on between the construction of the pyramids that he has gone into in past shows and your very own Coral Castle in Florida. So he's asking about, you know, thoughts on the construction of the pyramids and how it might connect to the Coral Castle in Florida. And he says, there seems to be correlations between the two, if for no other reason than the architect of Coral stated to some people that he knew how the pyramids were built, and if you take into account that he quarried, moved, and built single blocks of stone up to 25 tons on his own and in the dark by all accounts, then as a mason of the geological kind for over 25 years who relies on and curses gravity in the same breath, there's really no argument from me. So he thinks you might have mentioned this before, but he's not sure, and he really values your thoughts on this high engineering strangeness, which is a good description.
I wish I could answer to those high engineering strangenesses. The second trip I went to Egypt was with Robert Bavall and his brother Jean-Paul, both of whom are professional engineers. And Robert has spent most of his life in Egypt, actually. We did a pyramid tour, meaning we went to all of the pyramids, all of the main pyramids. I mean, there are, I don't know, about 100 pyramids around Egypt, but the primary ones, the ones you always read about in the books, we visited all of those, and of course we discussed them at quite some length, and we got to raise a lot of the engineering questions, because these are, in fact, professional engineers, and if anyone would know, they would. So we had quite a few discussions on that and other fascinating things that the ancient Egyptians should not have been able to do but were. Bobal was quite convinced that plainly they had some kind of advanced technology that we are simply unaware of, and so am I. I think in, any of us in the alternate Egyptology school, if you want to call it that, are at least agreed that the ancient Egyptians had technology that we are unaware of and that it was far more advanced than the traditional Egyptologists admit. I believe that most of us have the belief that that came from a prior civilization, that it was a legacy. And there is where you start having problems. Like, well, was it from this planet? Was it from another planet? Was it Atlantis? Where was it located? Who were these people? What happened
right,
to them?
Right.
That's when all the primary questions start really popping up.
Hmm.
So we agree that, that it's not necessarily ironclad answered who that civilization was or where they were located. But we agree that that civilization almost certainly had to have existed and passed this on as a legacy to Egypt. As to the actual technology involved, really guesswork. It's impossible to say. One of my guesses, given that Egyptian obelisks are hollow, is that it might have something to do with sound waves and sound waves being able to alter physical properties, but this is something that could be tested.
Right.
Now, I don't have the facilities to do this, but someone could test it. I do know that in raising ceremonies, they used to ring those like a gong or a bell, sort of. They made a musical note. And I'm wondering if, because they make a musical note today. I mean, if you hit them, you can do this with the king's coffer in the Great Pyramid. If you slap the king's coffer in the Great Pyramid, just give it a good whack on the side, it'll actually resonate on a note, and you can hear it. It's made that way. And the obelisks are also. And what I'm thinking is that the ringing of the obelisk or of the stone itself, because of the way it's built, might actually lighten its weight temporarily while it's doing that, because it might be exciting the atoms in some way. But this is, I really wouldn't know. I'm not a physicist. It's an idea.
Right, right. Right.
Since I know they happen to do that, and since I know these are extremely heavy, and yet they seem to pull them up with relative ease, it's something that could be tested and that someone might want to work on or try. That's about my best guess. When it comes to lifting the kind of weights that we're talking about for blocks of the pyramid, and the same for Coral Castle, man, obviously the guy that did Coral Castle was doing it on his own, and I do believe those reports because there's just no evidence that anyone helped him. And even if they did, we still wouldn't have an answer for how they were lifting those kind of weights, putting them into place, and setting them in such a way that, I mean, you can punch them and move them like a door, you know?
Yeah.
And we're talking massive weights here. How the hell are they setting them like this? These are just fantastic engineering feats. Well, this guy claimed to have been doing it on his own, and I believe him. For I think it took him 20 years, if I remember right, or about that neck of the woods.
Yeah, yeah. I haven't looked into it enough. Just the question alone, I just secretly typed in Coral Castle to not to look it up, but to set up a future show on
yeah.
VOA audio for this. Cause
well, it was like
a
hobby
story.
For him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I really want to know as much about it as possible. I've heard about it alluded to over the years, but I've never really dug enough into it.
Yeah, he was just going out periodically with, you know, his big pieces of coral and setting up a little bit more of the castle, sort of a recreation. And after 20 years, he had the damn thing built. And everyone's looking at it saying, how the hell did this get here? And he's like, well, you know, hey, guys.
Yeah.
So, yeah, how did he do it? Beats me. But plainly, if one guy could do this with these kind of weights, then this must not have been too difficult. Every time I asked Bobal or his brother about this, they're both real sweetheart guys, by the way. Jean-Paul's a real nice guy. Every time I would ask about one of these massive engineering feats, they'd be explaining the size of the blocks, the weight, how far in they were put, the type of tension and torque that it would take for even a modern crane of the biggest variety that we have to be able to do this, which it would not be able to, by the way. The tension and torque are too great when you go into the, further in. How the hell did they do it?
Right.
And they would always say, it was easy. And I would say, what was that easy way? And their answer was, I don't know. But for them, it was easy. It had to be, or they wouldn't have done it.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it makes sense. Clearly, yeah, yeah. They wouldn't,
they wouldn't just try and do something like that without knowing how to do it in the first place. So
with incredible precision. Mm. I mean, precision that we are not capable of. If we are capable of it today, we have not accomplished it today.
Yeah. All right. So I think that covers Mark's question. So we'll move to the next ones because
it covers it as well as I can answer it.
Right.
Personally.
Exactly. Yeah. If he was looking for us to explain to him how the pyramids and Gortle Castle were built, where he's
SOL. Why would I have
SOL.
A book there?
Would
I have a book there?
If we knew the answer to that, we wouldn't be doing this show. We'd be somehow, we'd be wealthy. We'd be like... We'd be working on something much, much bigger.
I would be a professional engineer myself.
Exactly. We'd be building these pyramids and Gortle Castles all over the country, for God's sakes. All right, next email or question comes from Ian. I think we can use his full name here. Ian Skullsaber, because I just like that last name. Ian Skullsaber, he says...
That's a great name.
I know. To start off, Bruce might be the only writer whose theories I agree with almost 100% outside of his opinion on Star Trek The Next Generation. Yeah, that's completely out of my basket of knowledge, so I'm just going to leave it there.
That is literally a generational thing. People from my generation really don't care for that show. It's too PC.
Hmm.
But people from, obviously, are from the younger generation, they love it.
He wants to know if you have an opinion on Deep Space Nine.
Not terribly. My friends were always trying to get me into Deep Space Nine. I've seen some episodes of it, and it's not a bad show. I enjoyed what I did see. But the guy that was most pushing that show on me over the years also happened to run off with my girlfriend at one point, and that kind of soured the whole thing for me.
Yeah.
So I just really never got into Deep Space Nine all that seriously. I did see part of the first couple of seasons, as I recall, and I remember there being some, there was a particular ufological element, but I can't remember the name of this weird ambassador. He's got this big costume on and kind of a single eye and a mask for a face. He struck me as a sort of a ufological element, but it's been so long since I've seen it. I mean, we're really going back here.
Yeah.
And I didn't watch it in any great detail, so I can't really go too much into that. I do know Harlan Ellison was involved with that at the beginning.
Is that the one with the lady captain? Right? Wasn't
was the
Kate Mulgrew or something? I could have sworn.
Oh, wait. Am I even thinking? I'm not. That's not Deep Space Nine I'm thinking of. That's... I just completely messed up your question. Maybe it was Deep Space Nine. No. Wait.
I have no idea. I might be wrong here. So.
I'm thinking of something else.
Oh, okay. Red Son Superman says, no, it was with the African-American captain.
Oh, yeah. Cisco.
Okay, so I was wrong. See, I don't know.
Cisco.
Yeah, okay.
Everyone I know loves Deep Space Nine. The question I was just answering was a completely different one, and I can't remember what show I'm talking about now. Sorry about that.
It's Rocksgiving. Don't worry.
We have brain farts. You get to be my age, you have brain farts. But anyway, Deep Space Nine I also didn't get into too much. I'll tell you, any of the post-Star Treks, any of the new boots of Star Trek, I never really got into.
What about the movies?
The movies? Well, I'll tell you, First Contact I thought was not a bad movie. And in fact, it was a pretty good one overall. And Nemesis I thought was very good. But those are the only ones of the next gen that I thought were worthwhile.
Yeah.
And of the originals, most of those weren't very good either. The second one was fantastic, Wrath of Khan. And the fourth one was a great deal of fun. And you want to talk about ufological elements, you bring the Enterprise back into our time and they are a UFO. You know, what are they doing?
Yeah.
They're going around doing whatever these advanced people are doing, which is a lot like what UFOs are about. That's actually a very fun movie. So those two in particular, I think, are pretty good.
Okay.
I've named two good original Star Trek movies and two good next-gen movies that I think are worthwhile. The ones that I named, I think, are very well-written and they're well-produced, and I can't say that for most of the rest of the series. The reboot that J.J. Abrams did, I thought, that's just fantastic. I think he's doing a really, really good job with that.
All right. Has Shatner been in either of those reboot movies, the new ones?
No, and he really should.
He's got a cameo, yeah.
He really should.
He probably will, maybe in the third one. Seems kind of ridiculous.
Well, he's getting up there. It would be nice to see him before he goes.
Yeah, if you can shoehorn Stan Lee into all these different Marvel movies, you can definitely
get Stan Lee appears in all of them.
Right. That's what I mean. So
you look forward, it's like Alfred Hitchcock, you look forward to the cameo. You know he's going to be in there somewhere.
Yeah. All right, so I think we covered Deep Space Nine. You never really got into it, so you don't really have an opinion.
Yeah, all of the post-Star Treks I just really couldn't get into. I tried them. I tried to get into them, but I just couldn't follow them. The Babylon thing is the one I was answering earlier. And I can't remember the name of that one either. Babylon something. Babylon 5.
Oh, okay. You're thinking of Babylon 5 instead.
I was thinking of Babylon 5 when he asked Deep Space Nine.
Okay. Because I bet you people would be like forever wondering what show was he talking about? So
yeah, it was Babylon 5. Anyway, yeah, the post-Star Treks I just really never cared for. Roddenberry was not always the most creative guy in the world, and most of his shows stunk, just straight up. Most of the original Star Trek working, a lot of that had to do with Leslie Stevens and is unacknowledged by most people. But Leslie Stevens actually had a lot to do with that. The guy that created The Outer Limits, he also had a big hand in the original Battlestar Galactica. He had a hand in a whole lot of stuff that was not always visible at the time. Didn't emerge until later years.
Yeah. Then he has a second question. Have either of you had the chance to check out Attack on Titan, which apparently I think is a manga series, because I Googled it. And I have not, beyond Googling it just now, I have no idea what about
it. No, I haven't either.
Attack on Titan. I never really got into manga or comic books or that. I really don't have, you know, I don't do that.
Oh, I do. I do like that stuff.
Okay.
I'm not big into it, but I do like that stuff. You can learn a hell of a lot from manga, Japanime, or any of that. And I'll tell you who does is Joss Whedon. Joss Whedon rips it off all the time.
Oh, I'm sure it's great. I just don't, you know.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer, that's Devil Hunter Yoko. And Firefly, the one that everyone's crazy about, but I wasn't so much, that's just Cowboy Bebop.
Okay.
He took Japanimes that no one had heard of in the West and westernized them, that's all.
Nice. All right. Yeah. Like I said, I just... never really got into it. I don't like yams either, so, you know.
They're definitely an acquired taste, just like opera and Shakespeare is how I like to put it, or ballet. You have to flip a switch in your head to appreciate it. You have to flip a cultural switch because it's completely abnormal by our standards. But if you're able to flip that switch and appreciate it on its own terms, you can learn a hell of a lot from that stuff.
Like Lucha Libre.
Yeah.
The next question here comes from Red Sun Superman, who is in the who's actually in the chat at this moment, so he'll be able to listen to his questions being read and answered. Red Sun Superman has a few here. He wants to know, what are a couple books that you've read recently that you'd recommend to BOA listeners?
Well, I have to preface this by saying that I don't, as a rule, read a whole lot of stuff about UFOs or related phenomena. I don't go into the New Age section and look for that stuff. So unless it's something that I happen to be researching at a given time, I mostly ignore it. I don't consider most of what's reported to be worthwhile anyway. It's usually just it's stuff that's coming from the intelligence boys trying to throw out disinformation for anyone who's doing actual research. Whenever there's an actual flap going on, and I know there's a question coming up about any flaps, I don't know of any recent flaps, actually, since about 2000 or that neck of the woods in Mexico. I know in the late 90s, there was a big flap in Mexico. That's the last big one that I really remember hearing about, which doesn't mean that there haven't been any other ones. But if there have been, I haven't seen them in the news.
Yeah.
There was a huge UFO thing that happened. I remember Fox News went crazy over this. CNN was going nuts over it, too.
This one in Texas?
I don't think it was the one in Texas. This was one that was going over the East Coast.
Oh, weird.
There was a massive UFO that was seen going from over several states in a given trajectory, and a whole lot of people saw this thing. And the boards were just lighting up all over CNN and Fox News. This would have been around right about the 9/11 time, actually, or shortly after. It was when we were heavily militarizing and getting ready to, you know, Empire Strikes Back and all that nonsense.
Yeah.
There was this huge UFO thing that was going on the East Coast. And CNN and Fox News both were literally just looking at the cameras with these kind of befuddled expressions saying, man, our boards are already lit up, but if anyone knows anything about this, please tell us, because we really do not know what this is. For about 24, maybe 48 hours, that was the big thing, especially on Fox News. CNN was hitting it pretty heavy, too. But then all of a sudden, bam, like it never happened. Never heard another word about it. Done. It was just finished. Like none of this that you had seen the last couple of days happened at all.
That's no surprise.
That's no surprise. And that's pretty much how this kind of thing gets handled anyway. So if there was a flap, I probably wouldn't notice. They'd put a squelch on it fast.
Right, right. You probably just kind of happened to be luck into seeing the coverage of at the time of it. Because, like, I'd asked
exactly.
about the Texas thing, and you didn't really...
You're talking about the one in like, 98?
I think it was...
Talking about the Phoenix lights?
No. There was one in the aughts that was in Stephenville, Texas. That's, like, the signature case of the aughts.
Oh, no, I don't know that one.
Yeah, see, so...
This is how far out of the loop I am. I was doing my research, and I'm pretty firmly convinced that I came up with the correct answers. So anything else is sort of extraneous to me. If I did come across something interesting, I'd be more than happy to talk about it. But really, I don't research it much.
Yeah.
Once I came up to... I'd spent my entire life studying this stuff. I came to my conclusions. I am pretty certain that I'm correct. And that's kind of the end of it for me. So I'm just researching all kinds of other stuff.
Nice, nice. In that vein, are there other books that you've read that you would recommend that you know, or is it just kind of like...
Oh, dear God, on what subject? Yeah, point me in a direction. I've read so many good books. I read all kinds of stuff. I read novels, I read nonfiction, and just a variety of different subjects.
Yeah.
Kennedy assassination, pirates, we got a pirate question coming up, mystery school stuff, Gnosticism. I read so many different kinds of books. Point me in a direction and I can maybe be able to answer, I can give you some titles.
All right. Well, he's in the chat, so maybe he will. And while he thinks about that, we'll go to the next question.
Sure.
At the end of the last Ruxgiving, Bruce mentioned possibly writing a book on pirates that connects with the Templars. Sounded like he might never write that book, so... Let's best a short version on how he connects the dots between the two, and if they are connected, what's at the bottom of Oak Island? Red Son Superman is obsessed with Oak Island, I should mention. So.
Well, and I can see why. Oak Island is something to easily obsess over. I don't have any definitive answers on Oak Island. I lean toward the Elizabethans, with Francis Bacon and Inigo Jones as being responsible for that. But that gets into a little bit of alternate history, and I'm not sure. It's really kind of hard to determine with Oak Island.
Yeah.
Whoever engineered it was really brilliant, and I do believe that the Elizabethans would have been capable of doing that. There could be a Templar connection with that, too. But again, this is all kind of nebulous. There's nothing I could nail down.
Right.
It's just directions that I look. I don't look at Oak Island all too often because it's just too perplexing. I'm familiar with its history, as are a lot of people. But, I mean, you just hit a brick wall with it.
Right. There's only so much information. So
that's right.
You could look at it, you know, because somebody was asking about it the other day on the Facebook page, and it was like, we did the definitive Oak Island episode like 5 years ago, and unfortunately, all it would be is someone coming on to tell the same stories and tell, you know,
that's
go
right.
over the same stuff. And it's like, I don't want to do that. Just listen to that episode.
Guess what? It's brilliantly built to baffle.
Yeah.
There's no way to get past it. It is impossible to. It can't be impossible to get past. But we have not yet discovered the way to get past it.
Mm. So that's the Oak Island part. What about the connection between pirates and Templars?
Okay.
Give us a little thumbnail on this, because I'm really interested.
The thumbnail will not be short, but I'll keep it as short as I can.
That's fair.
What you're asking for is some kind of evidence that Templars, Masons, and pirates are connected. I will give you that. And we'll see how short I can keep it.
Okay, we'll keep an eye on the clock here. No worries, though. No worries. It's all good. It's Ruxgiving. We're here to relax and have a good time and provide folks with a friendly conversation to listen to as they ride to Grandma's house Wednesday or
okay.
Thursday. So it's all good.
Okay. Well, this does happen to be a passion of mine because it's something that I latched onto a long, long time ago. I have to preface this story by a particular event, and that event is a pirate ship called the Widow. Now, for any Masons out there, if you think I'm saying widow, I'm not. It would be tempting to do so. It's Widow, W-H-Y-D-A-H. That was the name of the port from which the ship was launched. It was in West Central Africa, or Dahomey. The ship was called the Widow. It was a slave ship. On its maiden voyage, it was liberated by the Brethren of the Coast for pirate service, and I believe it only lived about a year after that before it sunk. It sank very spectacularly off the American northeast coast in a massive storm. The thing just turtled, went down, and about five people got off of it. Of those five, half of them or more were hung as pirates, and the rest were let go. We flash forward 165, 170 years into the 1980s, and the salvage team decides to go after the Witta. They know where it went down, and they find it. And from, I don't remember what year it was, 83, 86, somewhere in there, from that time to this, there have been occasional dives down there to pull up more of the Witta. We know for a fact that it is the Witta. There's no doubt in anyone's mind. Everyone knows for a fact that the Witta was a pirate ship at the time that it went down and had been for about a year. They know the name of the captain. They know a lot of the people that were on the crew. They know who was lost. It is the only authenticated pirate wreck in existence. We know for a fact it is a pirate ship, and we know for a fact that it is that pirate ship. Now, the vast majority of that ship's silverware has on it a unique symbol. That unique symbol is the square and compasses, which is distinctly Masonic. It is so distinctly Masonic that no one has suggested that it is anything else. It is a square and compasses, just like you would find at any Masonic lodge. What the hell is it doing on a pirate ship, on their silverware? Now, to put this in a little bit more context, Masonry as we recognize it, Freemasonry, did not announce itself to the world until June or July of 1717. I don't remember which month it was now, but it was one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
This pirate ship, the Witta, went down 2 months before London Grad Lodge announced itself to the world. So where did a bunch of pirates come up with the square and compasses before Masonry had even announced itself to the world? Playing devil's advocate, I can say, all right, maybe they got it from a ship that they plundered. That's not impossible.
Right.
But who else would have the square and compasses back then before Masonry was even known? The British Admiralty? They would be largely responsible for the creation of Masonry, presumably. But the British Admiralty didn't have squares and compasses on its silverware. So again, where did a bunch of pirates have it? No one denies that these are square and compasses. They are very Masonic in nature. And here they are on pirate silverware. Doesn't make any sense, does it? Until you start looking at everything else about the pirates. Most importantly, their most famous symbol. The Jolly Roger, the skull and crossbones. Whose symbol was that? That was the symbol of the Knights Templar. A white skull and crossbones on a black field. So you start looking further. Scottish Rite. If you know anything about Masonry, the Scottish Rite is loaded with pirate symbols. Loaded with them. Masonry not only has the same skull and crossbones, you'll find that even in the Blue Lodge as opposed to the Red. The Red Lodge is Scottish Rite. But you'll also find all kinds of pirate flag symbols throughout the Scottish Rite. A severed right arm holding a scimitar, the skeleton with the spear puncturing a heart that's dripping three drops of blood. That happened to be Blackbeard's standard. You'll find all kinds of, these are Masonic symbols is what I'm saying.
Right,
they're
right.
Pirate flags and they're also Masonic symbols.
I'm riveted here. That's why you're not hearing much from me right now because I'm on the edge of my seat listening to this.
I'm just touching the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
And because I'm going at it just kind of roundabout, I don't have it all marshaled.
Right.
I'm hitting things as they come to me. If you go into the Blue Rite rituals, the Blue Rite rituals, or the York Rite, as the Masons call them, are all written in 18th century British maritime language. You can't miss it. If you hear it, it's distinctly different from anything that's spoken today. There's a particular phrase that they use for the candidate. The phrase they use for the candidate is AB. Every time the candidate's name comes up, the name isn't there, it's AB. What is an AB? And Masons will ask this question all the time. The answer to AB is very simple. If you happen to know anyone in the Navy. The only place that uses that phrase is the Navy. It stands for able-bodied, as in able-bodied seamen. That's what an AB is. And again, this ties straight into the 18th century British maritime language that the York Rite Masonic rituals are written in. In the Masonic ritual, you will hear things repeated three times for no good reason. They just repeat them three times. They're repeated down the course of the lodge, from one officer's station at one end of the lodge to the other officer's station at the other end of the lodge by means of the officer between them in the middle of the lodge. They repeat the same thing. The master in this position of the lodge commands this to be done. The guy in the middle says, the master in that position of the lodge commands this to be done. And the guy at the end says, I have received the message that the master at that end of the lodge insists that this be done. Why do they do it three times? Because they're calling down the length of a ship. That's why.
Huh.
If you look at everything in Masonic ritual and you plug it into maritime, and specifically pirates and the 18th century, you will find a whole lot of it makes more sense than it does just by itself.
Interesting. All right.
And again, this is just tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because I think we could do a whole show on this. I'm fascinated. I want to talk more about it. But we've already gone 45 minutes. We got to do more questions here. So fascinating, man. What's the status on this potential book that you were talking about? Dealing with all this stuff? Because now this
I've never gotten around
right
to trying to write that because there's really no money in books. It's a hell of a lot of work, and there's just no money in it. I know Masons would buy it. A whole lot of Masons would buy it. Masons are really only interested in anything that they can directly connect to their particular rituals. And this I can definitely tie into their particular rituals. So I would have an audience there. But aside from that, a few anthropologists might pick it up. It interests me from an anthropological point of view, largely,
yeah.
And a psychological point of view, sociological. But in any event, it's just prohibitive to write a book. It takes too much time, and you really don't make any money on it. Even if you have an audience, you don't really make any money on it.
Okay.
I did write a play about it, though.
A play about, pirates.
About pirates, yeah. Masonic pirates.
Nice. What's the name of that?
Freeman Jack, which you'll never see. It's never been put up anywhere.
Wow,
I did
damn
write.
You. I was going to go look for it after the show.
Oh, don't I wish. Yeah, I'd love to see it put up.
He said, regarding the books, he said Gnosticism. So is there just one book? Because we gave him a lot here on the pirate stuff. So is there one book you can recommend for Gnosticism if people want to learn more?
Oh, dear God. Depending on where you want to go. If you're just trying to get a beginner's handle on it, then you want to go straight to Elaine Pagels. If you want to read an excellent book on it that not many people know about anymore, The History of the Devil and the Idea of Evil by Paul Carus. The last name is Carus. It is one of the best books on Gnosticism that I have ever read. Most people wouldn't recognize it as a Gnostic history, but it's largely a Gnostic history.
Yeah.
Anything that is a church heresy is a legitimate Gnostic belief. What the church was persecuting as heresy was Gnosticism under its various guises. So if you want to study Gnosticism, you can go straight to church heresies and you'll get the same thing. But I recommend Paul Carus especially. He was writing, I think right about 1900, if I recall. But I do know that his book got reprinted because I've got it. And it's just one of the best books that I've ever read covering Gnosticism. It goes into all the various sects. It uses the devil as its focal point, but what it's really talking about is Gnosticism when it comes right down to it. Because a lot of what the church was trying to prosecute was their idea of God was different from the idea of the Gnostics. And it was considered heresy by the church. That's the whole point.
Yeah.
They had their own dogmas and doctrines and all of that. Gnosticism did not fit comfortably into that, so they persecuted it. So that would be the place those would be the two places I would start if you really wanted to get into Gnosticism. I would start with Elaine Pagels, because she's the one that really started writing about the Dead Sea Scrolls and all of that, Nag Hammadi. And if you really want to get into the esoterica behind it, then I would suggest Paul Carus, who I imagine is probably still in print somewhere.
Okay.
And if he's not, I'm sure you could find a used copy.
All right. Dennis is the next questioner. He says, Bruce, could you tell us about your research process for Hollywood versus the Aliens? Specifically, where do you cull your info on abductees, and how do you correlate that info with specific movies?
Well, all of that's detailed very solidly in my books. If you just look in my notes and my bibliography, they're all there, and I cite them all in the course of the text. When it comes to information on abductees, a lot of it comes from David Jacobs, from Bud Hopkins, from John Mack, the primaries,
yeah.
And Ronald Westrom, I believe, was the name of one of the psychologists, and I want to say that was the University of Wyoming. There are a number of different psychologists and psychiatrists that have studied the subject and written about it and done some studies. I cite and quote them. I just named one of them. They're all in my notes and my bibliography extensively, and again, I cite them in the course of the text. When I'm actually referring to them, I bring their names up,
right,
and where they're located.
Right, right. All right. So check those out, Dennis. Go get the book. We usually ask this at the end of the show. Well, this is actually a good segue too, because we'll get to the question I was thinking of just now after this first question here. Joey wants to know. It's a perfect sort of lighthearted break in the moment. What is your favorite part of the Thanksgiving meal?
My favorite part of the Thanksgiving meal is the giblets. Straight up. I'm a turkey heart person. Chicken heart, turkey heart, all of the giblets. I even eat the neck.
You've got to be one of the most fascinating people I've ever met in my life, Bruce. And I actually haven't even met you in real life, but one of the most fascinating people I've ever talked to all these years. What with the giblets? Jesus, man.
Giblets are delicious. You can make a great soup out of them, and they just taste great all on their own. All of it. The gizzard, the liver, the heart especially, even the neck.
All right.
You have to be patient with the neck. But the nice thing about the neck is you can go back to it a couple times and, you know, just really work at it for a little bit, because there's some good meat on there.
Okay. All right. I'll have to keep that in mind. That's interesting. I would say...
And sweet potatoes. I'm crazy about sweet potatoes.
Okay. Sweet potatoes. All right. I like the stuffing, really. And the gravy.
Stuffing is great, too.
Stuffing and gravy, I think, are the two.
Anything you can put gravy on ranks right up there.
What I really like about the Thanksgiving meal is like that a lot of it you can kind of like mash together, and the flavors really work together so well. You know, like the stuffing and the gravy, and you just get a piece of turkey in there. Oh.
Oh, yeah.
Just amazing. I'm already looking forward to it.
Just in general, I'm actually a ham person. I'm not a turkey person, but I do like turkey. I'm also a dark meat person, if anyone's curious.
Okay. So the second part here is where I sort of tabled the spontaneous question I came up with, because Joey says, any new books in the future? And that's probably a good time. You kind of already answered that, so it's probably a good time also just to get sort of an update on the availability of Hollywood versus the Aliens and Architects. They're still pretty hard to get, I believe. So is there any news on that?
They technically went out of print 1 and 2 years ago, or 2 and 3 years ago now, I'm not sure. Technically they're out of print, and I've noticed a lot of scalpers online with that, which I find odd. I wouldn't think that they'd be something you could scalp, but apparently you can. I am planning on getting both of them back out. I was waiting for my financial situation to become more grounded, which wasn't going to happen until after Mom passed. That's still going to take a little while to resolve. The first thing I have on my agenda once that has resolved is to get the books back out. Not both at the same time. I'll probably put Architects out first, and then maybe a year later put... I'm going to have to take some time with the second one to figure out what to do with the pictures. The second one's going to be a little more difficult to get put back out, because I'm going to have to rearrange a bit of it. But the first one I should be able to put back out pretty much the way it was without really any difficulties, I think.
I'm sure we talked about this, but what about just throwing it out as a Kindle version right away? Because that seems to be...
Oh, Kindle would be part of it.
Yeah.
I would release it in both published form and Kindle.
Hmm.
Yeah, Kindle's definitely part of anything anymore. And I imagine probably the majority of the sales would be in Kindle, first off because it's less expensive, and second off because everyone seems to be going with Kindle.
Right.
Yeah, that would definitely be... It'll be available on Kindle, I'm certain.
Okay. Trust me, folks, once we know, you know, once Bruce knows what's going on with these books, you'll know, because, you know, BOA Audio is the conduit for any Bruce information. So we'll have a big celebration once these books are available for people to get a hold of, because I hear from people all the time, though, that are getting them, just they're like, you know, traveling through canyons and valleys and climbing mountains and...
Well, I saw a copy of it in a used bookstore once that I used to frequent that I almost picked up just because I don't really have any copies. I think I have one copy. I have my reader's copy, and that's about it.
Yeah. Okay, so that covers that one. James asks, what do you think of all these TV shows and movies about war? Is it possible they're propaganda? Could someone from the military be working on these projects to push an agenda? I think we know the answer to that last question is yes, of course. someone from the military.
What a loaded question. You already know what the answer is to that. I wrote books about it. Yeah, it's absolutely propaganda, and it's absolutely being put out specifically to prime us for exactly that. Absolutely. Yeah, that's the subject for entire dissertations or entire books, as I have written. Star Trek in particular, Chris Knowles likes to talk about this too. We're very much on the same page when it comes to this subject. Star Trek is really a totalitarian military state when you think about it. We show it benevolently, but it really is a totalitarian military state. The military pretty much runs everything. There's this kind of gray area when it comes to the Enterprise. What exactly are they? Are they a science mission? Are they civilian? Are they military? They're military. Just look at them. They're military.
Yeah.
They're in a warship, for crying out loud. It may be an exploratory vessel besides, but it's also a warship. And we've been trying to kind of sell this idea of a benevolent military to our populace for a very, very long time, which ultimately is just kind of a way of soft-selling war. You'll see movies like Starship Troopers coming out. Where's that set? A desert setting, going after an inhuman enemy that we're free to torture as we like, and we show all of this in the movie. I mean, we celebrate torturing the enemy. And very shortly after that, what happens? We invade Afghanistan, we invade Iraq, and we've legalized torture in the worst possible ways. Well, they were trying to sell that in advance, weren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is all very deliberate. Very deliberate.
Seems to be the case. It's troubling, but who knows, you know? They're just messing with people all the time anyway. They're just, you know, all this stuff is like, it's propaganda. That's what it is, you know?
It's propaganda. That doesn't mean it isn't good.
Exactly. Some propaganda is really good.
Yes, it's certainly enjoyable, and I may even in a lot of instances agree with it. But it is propaganda, straight up.
All right. Crystal wants to know, I believe we've covered this topic quite a bit on the, on previous shows with you, but it's always worth revisiting. She wants to know your opinion about whether or not you believe the U.S. really went to the moon and what you think about the lunar anomalies. And as I said, I know your answer to the first part of that, but like
yes.
I said, it's always worth revisiting. So your thoughts on U.S. going to the moon and lunar anomalies?
If we went to the moon, we did not go the way that we said we went. There are too many logistical problems. That does not mean we did not go. We may have, we may not have. We might have gotten all of our information from robot probes. That's how the Soviets got theirs. So I can't answer that question definitively.
Hmm.
What we saw on TV, that was fake. Jay Widener does a better job of explaining that than anybody, and he does such a good job of it because he has a testable hypothesis. And his testable hypothesis is that Stanley Kubrick specifically filmed the fake. He was the one that did this, and he shows how Kubrick did it. Well, once he shows you how, you can look at it yourself. You can look at any of the different moon shots, and you will see the demarcation line for the Scotch light curtain. That's it. If you light blast the images from the moon, Richard Hoagland did this, and he thought that he was seeing glass cities. He was seeing something. They weren't glass cities. What he was seeing was what looked like a luminous grid pattern. That luminous grid pattern, when you light blast those images, is the Scotch light curtain that Widener is referring to that Kubrick was using. He used it for his regular movies, and he used it for his fake moon movies. Again, it's a testable hypothesis. You can see the demarcation line. Once it's been pointed out, you can look at it yourself and you can find it. It's there. Plus, when it comes to The Shining in particular, his thesis is that The Shining was really a cryptic confession to Kubrick's having faked the moon shot. I fully agree with him. It's the best explanation I've heard for that horrible movie ever. I've never been able to make sense out of that terrible movie. But once I heard that and started applying what he had to say about it, all kinds of stuff leapt out that even Widener didn't see. That's why I believe him. His hypothesis is testable. I've tested it myself. I have found more information than even he has found on it, and it fits directly in with what he's talking about. I'm not the only one. Several other people have as well, which, again, it's been tested, and it's being found. So I find it to be very credible, and I'm throwing props to Widener here. I really wish he would write. I wish he would publish books. I believe he has a website, and he does talk about all this stuff quite a bit. He's put out some DVDs on it. But I would really like him to write a book.
Yeah, yeah. I forget the movie, but he did make a movie about it.
I think he made two.
Yeah, yeah, because there's one that has a really awesome theme song that's like...
Right.
Yeah.
There's one that goes entirely into 2001, and the other one goes mostly into The Shining.
Yeah, yeah. Either way, it has an amazing theme song. I should make that my ringtone. Once I hear it, it gets in my head all the time. It's like, under the Masonic moon. Oh, it's great, great song.
Yeah, but I know which one you're talking about.
Oh, it's awesome. It's awesome. It's like creepy and catchy, and you rarely see that kind of combination. So it's like, wow. Really,
Widener
really
has
good.
Actually been surpassed since he came up with his thesis. But like I said, there are a great many of us that have been looking into this. I know several people. And we've found a lot more than he has called attention to. That's not to slight him at all. The point is, it simply proves his point all the more. He came up with a hypothesis that anyone can look at and find.
Hmm.
Say, now that you're pointing me in the right direction, dude, you're right. Not only is all that there, but there's a whole lot more besides.
Yeah. That song's Masonic Moon by the Elders of Zion.
So, yes.
Great, great, great song.
Yes.
Okay, now let's see Crystal's second question here. She wants to know your thoughts on Ingo. Actually, let me read the full part. Cause she,
Ingo Swann.
Yes,
yeah, but go ahead.
She name drops a book here that might connect to it in a way. She says, I've read the book by George Leonard titled Somebody Else is on the Moon. It was eye-opening, intriguing, and alarming. She's also read Penetration by Ingo Swann and wants to know your thoughts about Ingo Swann remote viewing the moon and finding non-human beings as well as technology that's not man-made, structures, etc.
I have read Penetration. Let me preface this by saying I would love to read Leonard's book. I remember seeing that when it was on the stands back when I was in high school or just starting college, and I wish I'd bought it now because it's a lot harder to come across. I very much wish I'd read that book myself. I have read Penetration, and I find it to be an extremely intriguing book. Anything that is said by the remote viewers always needs to be taken with a grain of salt. I'm referring specifically to a lot of the latter remote viewers, Courtney Brown, for instance. A lot of their stuff kind of comes off a bit flaky and just weird. And I'm not sure what to make of it. They sometimes make predictions that just flat out don't come to pass.
Yeah.
So I always take them with a grain of salt. That being said, Ingo Swann was the guy that actually created the protocols for what our government uses for remote viewing. He's the number one guy in the remote viewing field for the government. He claimed, when he wrote his book, that he had given a promise to the people that recruited him into the government's program to do all this and set up the protocols, et cetera, and so forth. He said they told him not to talk about it for 20 years. He waited till after 20 years, then he wrote his book. So he honored his part of the agreement. Now, that part of it, I actually believe. I even believe most of what he has to say. I might even believe all of it. I have absolutely no way of testing it, is the thing. So I really don't know. And I have learned to regard these guys a little bit skeptically. Nothing that Swann has to say contradicts in any way my own conclusions about the entire phenomenon.
Yeah.
In other words, I don't have any great reason to disbelieve him. That does not mean that everything that he is telling me is necessarily the truth. It is possible that he is sliding a few deliberate inaccuracies in there just to not call more trouble down on himself.
Yeah, yeah.
But he did say that they only asked him not to talk about it for 20 years. They didn't say you have to stay quiet about this your entire life, blah, blah, blah. Just don't talk about it for 20 years. So he said, okay. And he didn't. And then like 25 years later, he wrote about it and said, look, they told me not to wait, and I've waited for well past that time, and I'm going to tell you what I know. I find his book extremely intriguing. It does not at all contradict any of my own conclusions. I even believe that it is mostly true. It might even all be true, but I have no way of being able to verify that. So I certainly find it interesting.
All right. I'm surprised you. I'm surprised you never tried your hand at remote viewing. Seems like the kind of thing you.
What tells you I haven't?
Tell me more.
I can't.
Oh, you. Oh, wow. What are you? Are you under a 20-year gag order too?
No, I am not under any kind of gag order, and I have never worked for any kind of official government. I've never worked for any kind of official government body or agency.
Hmm. All right. Very interesting. Okay. Well, when you want to talk about it, you let me know. I want to know more.
What's her Thanksgiving song?
No.
Pass the cranberry sauce. We're having mashed potatoes. Ooh, the turkey looks great.
Lynn.
Thank you for loving me.
Lynn.
Thank you for being there.
Oh, God.
Everyone's thanking.
Lynn.
The whole world's thanking you.
Stop.
Thanking
Lynn.
Us for thanking
Stop.
You.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Cranberry sauce. We're having mashed potatoes. Ooh, the turkey looks great. Thank you for loving me.
Lynn.
Thank you for being there.
Please.
Thank you for loving me. Everyone's thanking. The whole
Lynn.
World's thanking you. Thanking
Stop.
Us for thanking you.